This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 Chai FM.
And we are, this is The Deep Dive, and I am Brooke Spector, and this is, we're doing this live today. The tumult and the excitement of the government of national unity, as it may be, we are all sitting in anticipation. We've got a good program for you today, but first I have to read this poem. It's a short poem, and it's by Hilary Belloc. The New. The G stands for new, whose weapon of defense are long, sharp, curling horns and common sense. To these he adds a name so short and strong that even hard whores pronounce it wrong. How often on a bright autumnal day the pious people of Pretoria say, come, let us hunt the, and here's a dash. Then no more is heard but sounds of strong men struggling with a word. Meanwhile, the distant new with grateful eyes observes his opportunity and flies. That seemed oddly appropriate for this morning, Peter.
Yeah, I thought you might be going to sing us Flanders and Swan song. I'm a GNU, I can have a GNU.
I couldn't find it this morning, obviously. No, I didn't look for it. I got this one. Yeah. If you're wondering who my guest is, it is Peter Fabricius, a colleague at the Daily Maverick, longtime diplomatic observer, experience beyond almost anybody else in South Africa, was part of the Argus Foreign News Service for years, foreign news editor with the Argus Group, now writes with me on the Daily Maverick and does articles and think pieces for the think tank, ISS, based in Pretoria, which has an international reputation as well. Peter's now in Cape Town, where he enjoys close associations with all the people who are in charge of things. And Peter, it's really a delight to have you here. We're going to talk about the challenges and temptations of South Africa's foreign policy with the new, whatever we're going to call this government that's coming up.
that's a good topic, actually. Uncertain times, for sure.
Well, I mean, you wrote an article the other day which was discussing, without necessarily saying which way it was going to fall, that the current Minister of International Cooperation and Foreign Relations, Naledi Pandor, wants to hang on to her job even if she didn't win a seat in Parliament, and that there is some back and forth, some sharp elbow discussion going on about whether she will, should, or can. That's interesting, but I think the challenges for the country's foreign policy are even more interesting than the fate, the individual fate of Naledi Pandor.
Sure. Yeah, look, we'll see whether my sources are correct on that one. But what seemed to be important to me as a sort of implication of that is that it seems like the ANC in whatever coalition government, you know, is finally announced, and we're seeing the outlines of it. We don't know yet who's going to get which portfolio, but I was told, and I can believe that the ANC would insist on foreign affairs, and then maybe no one else, you know, like the DA being the second largest partner, one would assume, would particularly prioritize that. So in that sense, it seems that our foreign policy might not radically changed, maybe moderated and toned down a bit at the edges. You know, that's just a bit of a guess, really. But you know, what do you think?
Yeah. Well, my question is, and it's sort of aligned to this. To some degree, it seems to me that Naledi Pandor has so prioritized her two pet projects, the BRICS Association and criminal cases, international court and criminal court cases against Israel, that some of the other issues which might well be attended to are getting lost in the shuffle. And yeah. I, I can think of three that come to my mind, and I appreciate your thoughts on the matter. One is whether or not South Africa gets to, in some way, shape, or form, truly reassert its continental leadership in places like Sudan, the Eastern Congo, even Nigeria, all of which have difficult problems, and the Sahel more generally, and balancing somehow the way in which symbolically the relationship with the West, U.S., European Union, is balanced in the country's relationship with Russia and China. And that, of course, has Ukraine as a subtopic in it. I know that's an enormous landscape, but...
Yeah, no, I agree. Let's start with Africa, which is where you started. That is absolutely correct. And the Sudan is an example that is, you know, sort of screaming out for attention. I mean, South Africa has kind of tinkered a little bit with it. There have been some visits by some of the opposing, you know, leaders of the opposing factions in Sudan to Pretoria. You know, there's some effort by Accord, the that NGO that works closely with the government and trying to resolve African issues. But, you know, nothing like the kind of application, as you say, that's been given to BRICS and particularly to Gaza. So that is, to me, a failing. On the DRC, yeah, at a diplomatic level, as you know, we've actually contributed to a force of the Southern African Development Community that's entered there. I mean, we've had a force there, the Force Intervention Brigade, which is part of the MINUSCO peacekeeping mission for 10 years, you know, 10, 11 years. Now, a SADC force went in December, but its mission is quite hard to absolutely, you know, clarify and establish because it's run up against M23 rebels backed by it. So there are problems there, and a lot of people said that some sort of political framework needs to be articulated. And then on the West, yeah. So, I mean, the DA, for example, I think believes that if it were to enter this government of national unity, which now looks possible, and even if it's not holding the foreign affairs portfolio, it might help to mend relations a little bit with the US and the West, which have been somewhat damaged by both those initiatives, you know, the Gaza initiative plus the Ukraine, the position by South Africa, the sort of non-aligned, neutral, whatever, tilting towards Russia position on the Russia-Ukraine war. So, yeah, I mean, that's going to be quite interesting to see.
And I would throw into that mix, although it isn't historically seen as part of the foreign affairs portfolio, it is, in a way, quite central to it. It's the way in which the country is positioned symbolically to embrace foreign investment, the way in which the foreign missions of the country facilitate, encourage, nurture, the way in which domestic-oriented ministries, departments focus more assiduously on encouraging investment. In a way, it seems to me that DERCO has been sort of lost in the shuffle of all of that.
Yeah, you know, there are countries like, you know, one that comes to mind, Australia, which combine their trade and foreign affairs departments into one precisely to step up their economic diplomacy, which includes obviously encouraging investment, you know, boosting trade and so on. And our, by almost any measure, anyone who looks at it has concluded that our DERCO has not functioned well in the economic diplomacy area. And that's what a whole lot of attention should be given to, hopefully might be given to in a government where, you know, as I said, even if these other parties are not directly involved in foreign affairs and DERCO, they will presumably have some sort of voice at cabinet and so on where these things might be, you know. I mean, we've got some appalling situations like in Los Angeles, you know, for example. We have a consul generalship there where the last two incumbents have been actually condemned by disciplinary hearings within the department, but have not been fired, you know. So, we need some attention. Too many political appointments. I don't know if that's going to change. And because, I mean, there's a danger, I think, that that when you enter in this government, you create more posts, you know, and you've got to dispense patronage to more parties and more people, and so we might get more political appointments and diplomatic postings, which is not going to be great for our foreign policy.
We have to take a quick ad break and station identification. We have to pay those bills and have to follow all those regulations. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest this morning, one of two guests actually, is Peter Fabricius, foreign affairs writer, analyst, journalist, and we'll be right back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest this morning, Peter Fabricius, one of two, actually, and we're talking about South Africa's foreign policy challenges and temptations in the era of a new government, a government of national unity of some shape, texture, or form. We don't know, and we're trying to get the outlines fixed in our heads. Peter, we were talking about a range of questions that should get more attention. Have we left anything out? The one thing that comes to my mind, and maybe you can address this as well, is the way in which the current foreign affairs effort of South Africa does not take into sufficient inclusion all of the NGOs, citizen organizations, business foundations, business federations, and so forth, as a way of presenting a larger, deeper, richer picture of South Africa to the world. Does that seem to you to be an issue that could or should be addressed as well?
Yeah, whether it will be or not, it's hard to say, but certainly it should be. Yeah, you know, they've made efforts in that direction. It's, as so often happens with this government, some quite good intentions have been expressed, and the implementation has been dismal. I mean, they set up quite a few years ago, when Aziz Pahad was still alive and his deputy, they set up a kind of NGOs forum and an ex-ambassadors forum at Durka, and both were supposed to give input into foreign policy, but nothing happened. I mean, under Zuma, of course, the whole show, foreign affairs and everything, was completely sold out to, you know, external commercial interest, so that's not really surprising. And I mean, Zuma more than anybody else dished out patronage. I mean, the percentage of political appointments when he was president ran up to over 80. It's still quite high, but it's not as high as it was. So that is an issue. Lutuli House seems to be more dominant than ever. And as I was saying earlier, you get some really strange appointments, and even when they perform dismally, they, you know, as long as they have the right connections in town in Lutuli House, nothing happens to them. So yeah, that would help. It would help tremendously. Economic input from business side, as you say, plus just broader perspectives on a whole range of issues, you know, human rights, nuclear issues, etc. You know, from the NGOs.
Sorry, go ahead. Sometimes it seems to me that too often, even now, decades later, there is a temptation to fall back on old friends from the days of struggle. In the case of the United States, the Congressional Black Caucus and the veterans of the Free South Africa movement.
Yeah.
Rather than building the relationship with congressional staff members and staff and committee aides that are the key to making its case on things like the African Growth and Opportunity Act.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. There's this nostalgia for the old struggle days, which manifests itself in a whole lot of different ways. Look, I mean, there's a theoretical understanding, obviously, that the U.S. is very important. I mean, South Africa, you know, sort of deployed some quite serious efforts last year to save AGOA. As you know, they sent, you know, Pandor and Ibrahim Patel, the trade industry minister, and others to, you know, the finance minister also to Washington to try and say that. But yeah, There is a need for a much broader understanding, as you say, especially in Congress. Funny enough, we had an acting ambassador in Washington the last couple of months, last 9 months or so, because our appointed ambassador got very ill, and he was an experienced diplomat who had been in Washington and understood the need to. He would insist that all his staff go up to up to the Hill, whatever portfolio they were in, because he said that's who makes a lot of decisions in this town. So that was good. Whether that will persist when a permanent person is appointed there, we don't know. Now, that permanent person may be somebody from another party or whatever, but which up in the air.
Yeah, I get a little nostalgic in a funny kind of way for people like Harry Schwarz or his successor.
Drinkinson.
Yeah, thank you.
Drinkinson.
Both of them were very visible in Washington. We were there for part of that time, and they made something of a serious effort to talk to many different people and in many different ways. Even though they were in the transition moments, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the old, for all its faults, the old system understood the need to work the Hill, you know. Yeah.
That was their biggest strength in dealing with the United States. I mean, all the criticisms aside, they can still count on partnerships and relationships with congressional staffers.
Yeah.
Peter, I'm going to let you go because I know you want to watch the rapidly unfolding whatever it is that's going to happen. And we're going to call you back again in a couple of weeks, maybe a month or so, to sort of evaluate what has happened and where it's going to go. But in the meantime, we're going to let you off. We've been speaking with Peter Fabricius, colleagues from the Daily Maverick and veteran of international news reporting and analyzing. And we'll take this quick break, and we'll be right back.